Today is Thursday, November 30th, the year 2000. We're in Logandale, Nevada. I am Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Sylvan Whitworth for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, we've got a tape recorder here, Dr. Whitworth. Do you give us permission to tape this interview?
I have given you permission.
I'd like to start first with some personal background and educational background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school prior to college?
I was born and reared in Hurricane, Utah, and 1917 at the, I presume, during the First World War. Mm-hmm. And went to high school at the Hurricane High School. Graduated there in 1935.
What was that community like when you were growing
community
up?
Community like was, this was, of course, I was grew up during my teenage years, during high school, during the Great Depression. It was a very depressed area. Community was about 1,000 people, and we were poor. If we didn't grow it, we didn't have it. Mm-hmm. And we produced about everything that we were able to have to eat. We had no supermarkets then. We had a grocery store, perhaps, maybe a drug store. But we seldom went there because we had no money. Much of the trade that we encountered, of course, was by barter. We were on the farm, and we produced milk and eggs and meat, and often this would be bartered for essential groceries or, let's say, ice on Sunday to make ice cream.
That was essential.
which happened occasionally. But there were some things that we did have to purchase. And this was often done by bartering and by selling and peddling the fruit that we had in southern Utah at that time. Taking it further north into Cedar City. And I went often during the growing season, during the summertime, with my father to peddle fruit. And that was a small source of money income, cash income.
Did you have a specialty fruit?
Well, I grew up on a vegetable and fruit farm, and also, as I said, if we didn't produce it, we didn't have it. So there was grain and alfalfa. We had livestock, which was, of course, maintained by the crops that we produced for the pastures. And the meat that we were able to have was meat that we produced ourselves. Chickens, or pigs as we called them, and beef, and eggs, of course, that were available. Milk that was produced by the cows. This was, we were poor in those days, but we didn't know it. Mm-hmm. Because everyone else was poor. Mm-hmm.
Did you go on to college right from high school?
I was inspired. While in high school, I was in the what they call the Smith Hughes area in vocational agriculture by a very fine teacher by the name of Elmer Graff, G-R-A-F-F. And he often talked to me about Sylvan. He says, you should go on, get a higher education. And you should go on to obtain a doctor's degree in agriculture. And it was through the inspiration of that vocational agriculture teacher, who was also the basketball coach, to go on to college. Mm-hmm. And I owe a great deal to him and also to my parents, who likewise encouraged me to do so.
Did you play basketball?
I didn't play basketball. I despised basketball. It was the only athletic sport in the high school I went to.
Oh.
There was no track, there was no football. Mm-hmm. There was only one competitive sport, and that was basketball, and I hated it.
Oh. Mr. Graff was the coach.
He was the coach, but he was also the vocational agriculture teacher. And it was through the vocational agriculture program that I was inspired to go on to further my education.
And where did you do that?
That was done at Utah State, what was then Utah State Agricultural College in Logan, Utah. Now, of course, Utah State University. At that time, the university, or the college, the Utah State Agricultural College, had a total enrollment of about 2,000. And agriculture, of course, horticulture was an important department. And there I had the opportunity to have an advisor, Alma Wilson, who was also an inspiration for me to proceed to go on and do graduate work. Mm-hmm. And after, in the meantime, of course, I fell in love and married my sweetheart. And we were married when I was after I'd completed my junior year. And we likewise stayed on so that she could receive her degree. And in the meantime, there was a baby came into the family. And in 1940, I enrolled in 1935 at Utah State Agricultural College. In 1940, I applied for graduate work at three institutions, Texas A&M University, through contacts I had at Utah State, and also to the University of Missouri in Columbia, and also Cornell University. And I had to receive the same offer from each one, $600 a year, mm-hmm. as a graduate research assistant. Half-time, and the price was the same, $600 a year, $50 a month. In 1940, then I departed for the University of Missouri. I selected that university primarily because of the professor that I'd be working with, who was Dr. A.E. Murnik, M-U-R-N-E-E-C-K, A.E. Murnik. And so in 1940, in September of 1940, I, with a wife and a child, and all the worldly goods that we had, with a few cardboard boxes, we departed with the help of a friend to the University of Missouri in Columbia and arrived there. Mm-hmm. To me, that was a dramatic change. I'd never been east of the Rocky Mountains. It was hot and humid. Mm-hmm. And we'd never experienced that kind of a climate. And of course, an entirely new group of people, entirely new group of professors, a new university. It was a real challenge. And but we pursued this and graduated in 1943 with a doctoral degree.
What was your dissertation research?
My dissertation had to do with the physiology of reproduction in higher plants, with special reference to synapsis and syngamy.
All right.
And it became published in its entirety as a Missouri Research Bulletin 371.
All right.
It was reprinted several times. Considered by some of my professors at the University of Missouri as a classic, but published intact, no alteration at all. Took my thesis and published it as a bulletin, the entire thesis.
How did you come to that topic? Were you steered in that direction?
First of all, it had to do with horticultural crops.
Okay.
My interest was in horticulture, and my major professor suggested the problem, the area. And it was an area that I was very interested in to begin with. Actually, it involved the identification in a very crude way of naturally occurring growth substances or hormones in plants, phytohormones, that stimulated reproductive responses in plants such as flowering and fruiting. And one of the outcomes of this was the isolation with cooperation of people at Caltech in Pasadena, California, in the isolation of a new compound, indole-3-acetic acid, which is a naturally occurring plant growth hormone.
Mm-hmm. And how is that used?
It's used to stimulate growth of flowering and fruiting, mm-hmm. growth in plants. And of course, from this, many other analogs were derived that were even more effective than the naturally occurring. Mm-hmm. This often happens in the isolation of crude materials from native materials from plants, that there are sometimes chemical analogs that will be somewhat superior in certain reactions than the original material.
Mm-hmm. What happened after your dissertation and your degree? Did you get
I was encouraged to stay on at the University of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And actually at the University of Missouri, I earned $600 a year, $50 a month, with a wife and child, which was a challenge in itself,
mm-hmm.
even in those days, and was able to, with the aid of running apartments and managing them, and also growing a garden in Columbia, Missouri, and obtaining that degree without financial debt, with a wife and a child and a degree in 1943. After that, I was encouraged to stay on in the department as an instructor, which graduated my salary from $600 a month, or from $600 a year, or $50 a month,
mm-hmm.
to $1,800 a year. In other words, a threefold increase, which was dramatic in those days.
Were you living like kings?
not quite. But we were fortunate also in being able to obtain a home without a down payment.
Mm-hmm.
For $3,500 a month, mm-hmm. including taxes and utilities.
For 35?
Not utilities, but taxes and insurance.
Uh-huh.
For that's $3,500 total cost, $43.50 a month.
$43.50.
Which covered
which covered the
interest, which covered the payment on the home, and also covered insurance and taxes. Now, in those days, we didn't have income taxes, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, also, we didn't have to have driver's license for cars.
Mm-hmm. In Missouri.
Or Utah.
Mm-hmm. No driver's training, is that?
Well, there was no driver's training, and I think in Utah, my father purchased a car before I departed for college, about 1926, and I must have driven that car when I was probably 10 or 11 years of age or younger.
Mm-hmm.
Without a license.
Mm-hmm. My grandparents had purchased their first refrigerator before they had electricity. It was waiting on the porch.
We didn't have a refrigerator when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a radio until I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Because television was unheard of.
And how did you preserve most of your food?
The food was preserved by salting. Or by processing, canning.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bottling, as we called it,
mm-hmm.
and just dehydration. We had on the farm. We would slaughter the animals as we would need them.
Keep it fresh.
And it would keep by salting the bacon and so on. With pork, you could keep it through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, in those days, my father would go deer hunting. We would get fresh venison, at least in the fall of the year, for a while.
Mm-hmm. We had
rabbits and squirrels.
Uh-huh.
Rabbits and quail we'd shoot.
Squirrels.
We didn't have restrictions in terms of wildlife then that we have now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And hunting for subsistence was common.
Hunting was a common process.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have coal when I was in the at home in my hometown in the Hurricane. First time I saw coal was when I was in high school. We had to obtained our fuel by cutting wood in nearby mountains, the Little Creek Mountain. We'd go out and cut down the cedar and the cedar trees and the pinyon pine trees,
mm-hmm.
and haul them in and use them for firewood.
How far away was that?
About 20 miles.
Wow. Yeah.
That was the source of our
fuel. You went by horse and cart?
We by wagon.
By wagon. Mm-hmm. How long were you at the University of Missouri?
I was at the University of Missouri until 1946.
Mm-hmm. And then where was your next stop on the...
Next stop was Michigan State University.
How did you first hear about Michigan State?
Well, I attended a meeting, a horticultural meeting in St. Louis, Missouri. At that meeting, I gave a paper concerning my research at the University of Missouri, which at that time had graduated into growth regulator hormone effects on plants, which was considered of considerable interest at that time. In an international meeting of the American Society for Horticultural Science. And this was, of course, a very small society in those days, one could probably very near could have been a charter member of that society. Mm-hmm. But there were, for the entire United States, there was not a large number of people, maybe 30 or 40 people there. And I gave a paper, and there were those there that were present from Michigan State University, including Dr. H.B. Tukey and Robert Carolus, C-A-R-O-L-U-S, Robert Carolus. And they visited with me very briefly. I just came to know that they were there. And after the meetings, I received a letter from Dr. H.B. Tukey inviting me to come to Michigan State University for an interview as an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture. And I went for that interview. Remember, I took the old Grand Trunk Western from someplace in Missouri, I think it was Centralia, to Chicago, and then on to Lansing, Michigan. I'm not sure whether the old Grand Trunk Western is still a train that goes into Lansing, Michigan or not.
I took Amtrak from Leslie to Jackson.
Well, anyway, I arrived in Michigan, I was disoriented by a 90-degree angle. In other words, the sun was setting in the north, mm-hmm, instead of where I should have been. And I was disoriented for the 50 years I was in Michigan as a result of that. Never did get myself straight oriented, as long as I was in Lansing. Mm-hmm. But when I left Lansing, outside Lansing, I then became properly oriented with respect to direction.
I see.
Which resulted in me getting lost in Lansing even up until the days I left. But at that time, I was met by Dr. H.B. Tukey at the train station. We had breakfast together, then proceeded to go out to the university to be interviewed. And in that interview, I was interviewed by Director V.R. Gardner, the director of the Michigan Agricultural Experiment Station, one of the famous horticulturists of the past. I was also interviewed by Anthony, Dean Anthony. What's his first name? Can't remember his first name. Dean Anthony, the College of Agriculture. I was also interviewed by John Hanna, who was then the president of the university. And also as a guest in the horticulture department, Mr. Armstrong from Sunkist Corporation in California was also a guest when I was there.
Oh, really?
So I became acquainted with him. I remember that V.R. Gardner had his office, the director of the Agricultural Experiment Station, in the Horticulture Building, a temporary spot for him. Mm-hmm. But then I returned back to Michigan. Michigan State, of course, paid my way to come to Michigan, mm-hmm, to be interviewed. And then very shortly after I returned, I received a letter from Dr. Tukey inviting me to come to Michigan State University and join the staff as an assistant professor for the total of $3,800 a year. And I thought that was an enormous increase, over $1,800. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that sounded real good. And so we departed. It was difficult to find a place to live in those days. Dr. Carolla said, if you'll come to Michigan, we'll find you a place to live. We'll find you a house. In the meantime, I had a house in Columbia, Missouri, at 109 McBain Avenue, which incidentally is still there.
We went
back this week in Thanksgiving in St. Louis, Missouri, went to Columbia, saw the old house at 109 McBain Avenue in Columbia, Missouri, and the house is still there. Mm-hmm. That was the house we purchased without a down payment for, I think it was $4,200 total.
And it's still there.
And it's still there. Well, we decided then, that was in June 1946, that we would join, we were offered to come either July 1 or September the 1 to Michigan State University as assistant professor in horticulture. We decided on the date of September the 1st. So we departed and arrived in Michigan September 1st, 1946, with a tremendous salary increase. And by that time we had a second child, two little girls. And of course, having been in Missouri some 6 years, we had quite a few, we had many friends in Missouri. And it was a little difficult to leave there, but we immediately made friends in Michigan. Now, one of the interesting sidelines to this story is that when I was invited to Michigan, they thought I was someone else. There was another professor, another young man at the University of Missouri by the name of Ray Schroeder. And they thought they were inviting Ray Schroeder, and I showed up instead. And I didn't learn of that until years later. But my appearance there was impressive enough that they hired me.
That's amazing.
That's a true story. I didn't learn that originally.
How'd you find that out?
Someone told me at Michigan State.
Oh.
I don't know if it was Dr. Tukey. I think it was Dr. Tukey.
Uh-huh.
And that was an interesting introduction. Well, at Michigan State University, of course, things went very well.
Mm-hmm.
We.
How would you describe the campus in those early years?
Well, Berkey Hall was being built, mm-hmm. and was used entirely for a classroom, because the great deficiencies at Michigan State University were classrooms for students.
Mm-hmm.
There was an enormous enrollment that happened in 1946. About 10,000 students arrived, 10 to 12,000 students. And that had not been the case during the war years. And they were hiring lots of people. And the classes were, just place to hold classes was a big big challenge. And that's what Berkey Hall was used for. I think it's still used for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
If Berkey Hall still exists there.
It does.
Across the street from the Horticulture Building.
It does. And
there was just not the capacity to teaching capacity. And of course they lacked professors and lacked space. And this was during the great and grand period of John Hanna, when there were many buildings being under construction. Many buildings were being planned and developed. The auditorium, the greenhouses back of the horticulture building were the only greenhouses on the campus. And in the horticulture building itself, there were no chemical laboratories, only one big one that was used by everybody. And one of the first things that I did rather early in my career in the 1950s was to make an application to the National Science Foundation for $150,000 to refurbish, construct, build, get some laboratories in the building. Teaching laboratories, research laboratories. And that was one of my first successful endeavors, was to persuade the National Science Foundation to make a sizable contribution to the development of laboratories in the Horticulture Building. Another was, of course, another venture, and Dr. Tukey at this time had, with the State Horticultural Society, Michigan State Horticultural Society, the intent of obtaining $1 million. $1 million to remodel the horticulture building and to initiate the building of new greenhouses, which came to be known in about 1950 as the finest greenhouse structures in the United States, known then as the Plant Science Greenhouses out on Farm Road. They're still there,
mm-hmm.
but of course have been had many other facilities added to them since then. But I remember that Dr. F.W. Wendt from the California Institute of Technology came by as a guest. F.W. Wendt, W.E.N.T., was a very famous plant physiologist. And he commented, he says, "You have the finest greenhouse facilities in the United States." This is when Dr. Wendt was at the California Institute of Technology and had developed the so-called phytotron. And that, of course, was a very good facility. But this...
Dr. Tukey was successful in that
yes.
Fundraising.
Yes, Dr. Turkey was very successful in fundraising. He was a good department chairman. I enjoyed every moment I had at Michigan State University.
Mm-hmm.
During the some 40 years that I was on the faculty, I stayed 10 years after I stepped down from being the director of the experiment station. Mm-hmm. During those 40 years, I was associate with Michigan State University. I was every year I was given a salary increase, which is more than I thought I deserved. I was more than satisfied with the way that Michigan State University treated me. I owe a great deal to Michigan State University for its for what it's done for me, for the privileges that I had there, and the opportunities that I had, the research facilities I had, the money I received from the university, the support I received from the university.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tukey recognized your abilities in research and
Dr. Tukey recognized my abilities in research and in teaching, very much so. The dean did, the director did. Following Director Gardner, of course, was, I believe, Cliff Hardin. Then Cliff Hardin became later the Secretary of Agriculture. He became the Dean in the College of Agriculture. And he in turn was followed, as I recall, by Lloyd Turk.
Did you replace him?
Yes.
Well, that was
a situation that Lloyd became somewhat non-functional.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went in as Director of the Experiment Station, I didn't want it.
Mm-hmm. What year was
by
that?
By the year 1963, probably about 18 years after I arrived, 1964, 18 years after I arrived at Michigan State University, there was a need for a new director of the Agriculture Experiment Station because Lloyd just wasn't doing the job, had problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the dean, that Dean Cowden was the dean at that time, he followed Cliff Hardin, Tom Cowden, T.J. Cowden, C-O-W-D-E-N. And I had good relationships with all the deans and the directors and the professors there. But Dean Cowden called me over several times. Well, in the meantime, of course, Dr. Tukey passed away, or was retired, didn't pass away, he retired, mm-hmm. had to retire. And he was replaced by John Carew as chairman of the Department of Horticulture. John Carew was a good department chairman, but then after a few years he got a brain tumor, malignant, and he died. But prior to his death, two or three years before that, this was when Cowden was inquiring about a director of the Agriculture Experiment Station. And he called me over several times. I said, "Dean, I'm not the man." I said, "I've recommended to you now several times, I've recommended," and I run down the list, and I said, I don't want. He said, "Well, the last time I was there," he said, "well, all I want to know is whether you're interested or not," after been there three or four times. I said, "Dean, if I tell you I'm interested, that's a commitment. I don't want to make that commitment." Well, anyway, he finally persuaded me to say I would be interested.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at myself and I said, "Look, will I be able to look at myself in the mirror the rest of my life if I don't respond to this?" And but I didn't want it. I had at that time I had several postdoctorals,
mm-hmm.
I had several graduate students, and I had a separate laboratory. I had all the research grants I wanted, and I was a full professor. I did what I wanted to do. And but anyway, at that time, well, here's the group right here. This would be of interest, it's in my history.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called the Great Group. And this was by one of my graduate students, Sis Hadri Cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And then over here, Sis Hadri Cannon has written a little of my history also.
Mm-hmm.
And there he talks about the Great Group. And So I had what I wanted, and I was getting research grants from NSF, and I had postdoctorals all over the world, mm-hmm. and but anyway, I was ready to depart on a foreign trip for about 5 weeks. I'd been invited to come to go to Ethiopia, to the Netherlands, Italy, to Lebanon, and to Turkey with a series of presentations of former graduate students that got in the act, you know, and well, and Cowden got wind of it, of course, he was the dean. He knew I'd got there. That was about the middle of May. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want to see you before you leave. And we met in Kellogg Center. I had breakfast there. And I remember that Cowden was there and the provost. Who was the provost at that time?
In 1964?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
Well, he was there.
Okay.
And the president
we'll
showed
look it up.
And the president showed up. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, I said, this is it. Mm. And so they want to know, are you interested? Mm-hmm. I says, yes, I could be interested. And I left. That was in the morning, and at 10 o'clock I was on my way to Detroit and international over to the Netherlands,
mm-hmm.
Didn't come back until about the middle of July, and of course when I arrived.